This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Imani Bazell, who for 5 years has been the director of the Center for Civic Engagement and Social Justice at the Urban League. Welcome, Imani.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
And you were telling me you have just left this position.
Yes, though I continue to do the same work around what we're talking about today, civic engagement and social justice. A lot of work in the context of the African-American community, a lot of work in public schools, healthcare access, those kinds of things.
And you have a weekly radio show on WFT Thursdays, and you're on from 8 to 9 in the morning.
Yes, called Speak Up. Okay. Just like you, trying to get the public engaged, to keep a dialogue going, to try to keep breathing life into the democratic process.
Well, thank you for coming to be on WILL today. We're going to be talking with Imani for about 45 minutes about some of the African-American election issues. And then for our last 10 minutes or so of the show, we'll be talking with David Eisenman, who will be joining us to talk about the current national financial picture. So he has some interesting ideas to share, and it'll be a lead-in to This American Life, which is going to have a whole hour on that. So, but to get started with Imani, Imani, tell us a little bit about the history of black voter involvement in this country.
Well, I think that it's interesting because I think most certainly literate Americans know there's a long history of suppressing the black vote. Certainly,
completely.
Yeah, certainly it wasn't until the 15th Amendment that black males got the legal right to vote, though they certainly were never really able to exercise it in any great numbers until actually the Voting Rights Act of 65. Mm-hmm. It's been a long struggle, Steve. You know that. Interestingly, though, it's exciting. It's so much of the effort to enfranchise African Americans has really tested American democracy, really, I think, helped our concepts of democracy evolve. And I think even though we continue to struggle around issues of voter suppression, these struggles, these social movements that have ebbed and flowed over the years have contributed greatly, I think, to this country and the world's best understanding of what participatory democracy can really be. So I think our struggle has helped enrich the country as a whole, and I think continues to do that in a new way with this historic candidacy of Barack Obama.
The black voters in this country have shifted parties, the majority of them a couple times. It's been a very interesting history. Starting out following Lincoln with the Republican Party,
right,
and then in the last century switching more to the Democrat Party. Of course, there are still conservative and liberal,
sure,
black voters. How do you read what the participation might be with the first African American candidate for presidency? Will there be a historic turnout?
You know, Steve, I think so. But let's back up for a moment,
sure,
and make sure that our listeners have some sense of this history you're talking about. So with the passage of the 15th Amendment, so this is post-Civil War. Mm-hmm. At the time, we can editorialize, right? You told me that before.
Absolutely,
we came on
if
the air.
Disagree, they can call right
absolutely
in.
Absolutely. They can call right,
right
in. One of the things that really irritates myself and many other African Americans is the current Republicans and Republican leadership claiming to be the party of Lincoln. And in fact, they are not the party of Lincoln. the current GOP is not the GOP from the Lincoln era. And so I want to say that the parties have transformed over the years, and they're not who they used to be. So we shouldn't be fooled by names. So originally, as you said, black people were a part of, or black men joined the Republican Party, because that was the party of Lincoln, and Lincoln had signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But almost immediately, so we had this area of, this era of Reconstruction, right? And we saw black schools emerging in the South, what we now call HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities, one of which I attended, Fisk University in Nashville. We saw black men getting elected to governmental positions locally and nationally. But that didn't last very long. A deal ended up being struck fairly early on between the Republican and Democratic parties that had to do with really the South and the North. And the deal that was struck was the Southerners got what they wanted in terms of getting their properties back in the South following the Civil War, and Northerners got access to Southern markets, which is what the industrialists want. And the trade-off was suppressing the black vote, making the black vote more difficult. We see the emergence of Jim Crow laws, sure, and that kind of thing, right? Literacy tests and all kinds of nonsense like that that carried us through into the 1960s. But when we see the shift from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party was in the New Deal era. So with Roosevelt and the New Deal, you saw this shift of blacks really en masse from the Republican to the Democratic Party. And that had to do with the party's values and who was represented and what was represented by the party's platforms.
And part of it was the African-Americans who, in many of them in coming to the North, joined unions.
Absolutely.
And were involved in the...
Exactly. So the parties themselves transformed, and
sure,
in the process, the Democratic Party became more of the party of the people, so to speak.
I want to get back to that. Let me give listeners the numbers that they can call if they'd like to join this conversation with Imani Bazell, our guest here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We're eager to have people join the conversation. And if it's a long-distance call for you, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, elsewhere 1-800-222-WILL.
So, Steve, you asked me about the range,
yes,
in the African-American electorate, right? You started
today,
off with this.
Sure.
Yes, today. Right. Some are Democrat, some are Republican, many are third party. If I can, I don't want to be too circular in our conversation, though I do tend to be circular. You can work with me,
that's
right?
Fine.
Okay. I want to say, Steve, that there is a lot of manipulation. There has always been a profound manipulation of the black electorate, and we see that still today. And so the early manipulation, of course, had to do with disallowing enfranchisement and then having it legally but not practically. That's the difference between, right, de jure and de facto. De jure means legal. De facto is but what happens in real life. So one of the things that we've seen in recently in what looks like the growth of blacks in the Republican Party or the growth of blacks to the right of the political spectrum, part of that manipulation has been creating an image. And so you have, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about Rovian tactics, right?
Karl Rove
and his tactics. And so one of the things that Rove and his people did early in the Bush administration. We saw this, a lot of this manipulation with the, given that we're talking about keeping the faith on this show, the faith-based initiatives, for instance. One of the ways that they were able to early on begin to try to manipulate the black electorate was by dangling those funds in front of the black clergy and black business people. And so what you saw was they did not like who Black America identified as its traditional leadership. And so what they did was sort of handpick their own people. And if you put them on the news enough times, right, if you control enough of the media and keep saying this person, you know, this leader,
sure,
this leader, this leader. So there was a big meeting early on, and they had a big press conference with Bush talking about the faith-based initiatives, and they were about. And so the New York Times and Washington Post and Wall Street Journal and all these folks take what Bush is saying he's having a meeting of essential black leadership. Well, they were all handpicked people who would represent what they stood for. And if you say it enough and you keep giving them platforms, just like now, we see you can turn on CNN, for instance, and there are these sort of handpicked black Republicans who represent themselves as speaking for the black community. And so that has been a very interesting manipulation that has taken place, and I think quite successfully, though the numbers of African-Americans who vote Republican are still incredibly, incredibly small. And one of the interesting things we see, Steve, is even those who have moved to the right, if you will, which tend to be people of a certain economic class, I think we see that across race, they're having trouble with this Obama thing, you know?
Sure.
So we're seeing people who would traditionally identify as black conservatives still being so moved by this social movement, because the Obama campaign is much more than just the presidential campaign. It's turned into a social movement. And so we're seeing even them being more muted and much more reticent to say negative things about him. And we see people like Colin Powell, for instance, who sort of won't state where he is, right? So you see people like that. And I've certainly seen people who identify as black conservatives even saying this time around, they're going to vote for Obama. So it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party has had difficulty making connections often with Christian evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that changing at all?
You know what?
Because there's so many black
exactly. evangelicals. And that's really the connection. One of the things, again, with this faith-based initiative of the Bush administration is you had many, because we know much of the leadership in the African-American community over the decades has emerged out of the black church, which is, you know, black folks are pretty religious because that's sort of the only thing we own. Certainly in this community, and I think in other communities, the only thing black folks owned was our churches and the Urban League in terms of actual brick and mortar
institutions,
where
sure.
there is an address and a phone number
yep.
and a black person to pick up the phone. That's it.
Right.
That's pretty profound. Mm-hmm. So anyway, one of the ways they've been able to manipulate, as I said, the African-American community and leadership has been through dangling these few dollars. And so you ended up seeing many African Americans then parroting this white right wing evangelical, very narrow agenda without really thinking, you know, this very sort of anti-abortion thing, as though that everything revolves around the question of the right to choose, as opposed to issues of poverty and social justice and that kind of thing, which many evangelicals are absolutely social justice activists.
Sure.
They just, over the Bush administration years, have been, I think, drowned out by the right-wing part of the evangelical movement. And it seems to me in this election cycle, we have seen the left of the evangelical movement, I think, begin to rise, and we can hear more of them. So we can see that Christianity, and in fact, evangelical Christianity, is diverse, mm-hmm. and not just solely defined by the Pat Robertsons of the world. So that's been quite refreshing. And what it does, it has allowed many African Americans who are strongly, strongly religious and could be identified as evangelical as being much more comfortable to say, I'm an evangelical and I stand for social justice. So that's been quite interesting to see that turn around just in this cycle.
What's the spirit currently in the local African American community about the local election? About the national election?
Well, I tell you,
it's too early to see yard signs. So
well, we're starting to see the yard signs because we're a month out now. Uh-huh. So I'm seeing the yard signs pop up. And because we can state where we are, anybody knows which house is mine when they drive down Paula Drive, let's be clear. Oh, that must be Monty's house. So, yes, I last year, or really up until July, I was doing a show on local soul radio, WBCP, mm-hmm. Once a week. And mostly our talk was around politics and the election. And I would often, Steve, say, listen, it's okay. Everybody can call in, state your opinion. You know, yeah. If you're a Clinton supporter, if you're a McCain supporter, or whatever, still during the primaries, it's okay. You can call. I'm sorry. 99.9% of all the calls were always about Obama.
They were. Uh-huh.
I got one call over all those months. One call. I was pleading into the mic, listen, it's okay. And this older white woman, I'm sorry, older black woman called.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, I'm supporting Clinton. And she was so hesitant. I said, oh, it's okay. You know,
yeah.
just
yeah.
encouraging her to talk more. And just through the discussion, it became very clear she actually wasn't a strong Clinton supporter and was having a lot of conflict.
Uh-huh.
And so there is a level of excitement that I think exists here and around the country.
Let's see if our listeners would like to join the conversation. The numbers are 1-800-222-9455. That's the toll-free number if you're calling long distance to Urbana, Illinois. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, it's a local call, 333-9455, to be on the air with our guest, Imani Bazell. And we do have a caller, I see,
Yay.
On our toll-free line, number 4. Yes, go right ahead, please.
Yes, Steve. Thank you for this program, and my congratulations to the lady who is so elegantly expressing the opinion. I am concerned. We are told that we are not to judge anybody's Christianity, particularly George Bush, who claims apparently that God speaks to him. It's a wonder that God has not told George the difference between Calvary and Cavalry.
Oh.
When we first went into Afghanistan, he explained that this was the first modern cavalry attack. Now, on to another thing about evangelical Christians. I don't see how any Christian, be they of that sort or mainstream, can think of voting for McCain. You know the Scottish naming pattern, McHenry means the son of Henry.
Mm-hmm.
McGeorge means the son of George. What then does McCain mean?
Uh-oh.
The son of Cain, the first murderer, the first criminal in Genesis. I would like someone put this on the internet, to which I do not have access, but just think about a man who is almost Antichrist in his name, proudly bearing that name through the generation. That is all I have to say, but thank you for letting me express this ad hominem attack.
Thank you for your call. We have a couple other callers waiting on local lines. Monty, did you want to respond to that, or should we go
just,
on to
It's just delightful when people get a chance to say what's on their mind. That's I good. Love that.
All right. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes.
Hello?
Yes, line number one.
Hi. Listen, this is a great, great, outstanding program. The gal that you have speak, I'm a 55-year-old white man. I'm a fervent Obama supporter for a lot of different reasons. I don't remember your name, but you
Imani,
you have articulately expressed what so many of us are trying to express, and your choice of words are absolutely magnificent. I wish you could have a larger group of people, you know, to express those same opinions to them. They're just fantastic, and I don't know how you do it, but thank you very much for expressing what hundreds and hundreds and maybe millions of us also feel about Obama's appeal to the mass audience.
Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. And we'll go to line number two. Yes, line number two. You're on Keeping the Faith with Imani Bazell, our guest.
Hello, how's it going today?
Wonderful.
I'm calling. I'm traveling on the road. I actually live in Memphis, Tennessee, and I picked up your program, and it's been great so far.
Yay, Memphis! You heading down 57?
Yes, ma'am. and you really were right on target with a lot of the African American churches, as far as the ministers receiving the faith-based initiative money, and you know, trying to persuade their congregations to vote Republican. We had that with a lot of our mega churches, at least three or four of them, that they had about 4,000 or 5,000 members each.
Yep.
And I saw the ministers prospering, but what the members of those churches don't realize is that the community still suffers.
Sir, you're exactly right.
And, you know, you know, it's really not a battle for me to fight, you know, to talk bad about anybody, but I see a lot of people being tricked, you know, just voting for Republicans, and these people haven't even come into your community, and your community is still suffering.
Malcolm X used to call it being bamboozled.
I remember that last week I had pulled out a sermon, The Ballad of the Bullet, for my kids.
Speaking of Malcolm X.
Back in 1964, and as we were eating dinner, my wife was saying everything he said could apply right now. But, you know, like I said, I've enjoyed your program, just listening to you on the road, and you know, it's been a joy.
Well, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, good for you, Steve. You're reaching far and wide, huh?
Well, let me just mention that this program is available online as well, and we have listeners we know not only around this country but around the world. We can't accept calls on our toll-free line from outside the continental U.S., but many people do listen at WILL.illinois.edu and click on AM, and they can hear the program live, and they're also archived there.
Yes,
so if people have missed
it's quite
the start
wonderful.
Of this program or others, they can...
Because sometimes your radio reception, even when you're right in town, if you're in a building, it could be bad, but you can be at work and just tune in on your computer if it can't come in on your radio.
That's right. People who are driving and go out of range, or they can't, they have to get somewhere and can't hear the end of the program, they can go and hear the archives.
So yes, that's wonderful. Very handy. You know, Steve, I wanted to follow up on, I believe it was the second caller. One, let me say I really appreciate these calls. And I know it's not a vote for it's not a vote for me personally to say, oh, she's so wonderful. It's the ideas. And what I'm hearing these callers say is there is a particular POV or point of view that I'm representing that they want to have more access to the airwaves, that this POV should be heard more.
And here's another caller on line number one. You're on the air of Keeping the Faith here on WILL with Imani Bazell, our guest today.
Hi, how are you? I have an observation, and then I hope Imani will respond in her inimitable way. I am also, as a non-religious person, praying that Obama will win. And the observation would be that then the majority of votes would be white votes, and to bring him into office. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are about race relations, not in the respect of Obama getting this office and then people not recognizing that there are racial problems, but rather the overwhelming coming together to see him in office.
Excellent, excellent caller.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Actually, just before she called, Steve, that's what I was getting ready to talk about, because I think the second caller who made the point that he was a 55-year-old white male who was an avid Obama supporter, I wanted to make sure that I point out, Steve, even though you invited me to come on the show to talk about the African-American electorate, it is inextricably connected to the broader electorate, because we're just 15% of the population. One of the things that Jesse Jackson spoke so eloquently about when he was running for the Democratic nomination in the 80s, one of the most memorable Democratic convention speeches was his speech about the quilt. You know, that each piece wasn't big enough, and he was talking about developing doing real coalition work. And that's why I'm calling the Obama campaign less of a campaign and more of a social movement. And so we've even found people who might, under other circumstances, vote third party, say Green Party or something like that, latching on. I brought a bunch of stuff to share, and I know there's not time to do it, but there's a really profound statement from progressives, from the progressive community, people who are recognized progressives in the national movement, recognized leftists, who have said, we need to be a part of this. We didn't even realize how important this was. It is really important to recognize that this is so far beyond race, that this movement has sparked people's hope, not just in this country, not first in Illinois, right? He's from Illinois. People are excited in Illinois across race. Certainly, without the white vote, he never would have become a senator. There aren't enough black folks in Illinois to have made that happen. He stands for something so much more than that. Come on, how many people showed up in Germany to see him everywhere he goes? So this is clearly way beyond race. But and it's exciting. It represents the opportunity to turn, in many people's minds, I think, to turn the world around, because we are, in many people's minds, on the brink of disaster globally. And so I think what he is representing for people across race and class is an opportunity to steer the ship in another direction, period. And when I think, Steve, about voting, as committed as I am to the empowerment and liberation of the African-American community, more than anything, I have to be honest, I feel as though when I go press the button on November 4th, I'm actually going to be voting for the people of the world. I feel that people have been so clear to us that they are holding their breath. They are counting on us to get it right this time because the world is in so much trouble and mostly at the hands of the current administration. So a lot of this is about casting a vote for the world.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon with our guest, Imani Bazell, who is, for the last 5 years, been the director of the Center for Civic Engagement and Social Justice at the Urban League here in Champaign County. We'll be getting back to Imani in just a moment, but let me take a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, but I have been gone for 5 consecutive weeks because I recently retired as director of the University Y, and my wife and I took a very long trip out to the Pacific Northwest and saw old friends and family and got to see 2 of the states we had never visited, Washington and Alaska. We might talk about Sarah Palin a little bit here in a minute, an African-American response.
Oh, gosh, could we?
Yes.
Gosh, but, darn it.
But what I really want to talk about with Imani in our last 15 minutes with her before our second guest, David Eisenman, helps us talk a little bit about the financial crisis in the country. I want to ask Imani about white racism and whether we can trust polls that say whites will really vote for Barack Obama. But let's wait just a second. 2 big topics, but next week our guest will be John Sutherland, a Lutheran pastor who spent 2 years in Palestine, and we'll be talking about with him thinking about Palestine, his thoughts on that experience. On October 26th, Sister Agnes Cunningham will be our guest, talking about her very illustrious life as a Christian theologian. A Catholic sister, Sister Agnes Cunningham, will be our guest. On November 2nd, James Wellman, M-A-N-W-E-L-L-M-A-N, will be our guest. He's the author of the recent book, Evangelical versus Liberal. And it's very appropriate that he'll be on the Sunday right before November 4th election talking about those issues. He's a professor at the University of Washington. Daniel McCollum will be our guest November 9 talking about the Lord was not on trial, the church-state separation issues that his family was involved
with. Oh, that should be good.
Went all the way to the Supreme Court. So there's some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith, and I want to give a special thank you to Don Nolan, Professor Nolan from Parkland College, who hosted this program the last 5 weeks so ably. I was able to pick up a little bit online myself and heard some of that as we traveled, and I want to thank him and the guests we had over that time period. But let's get back to Imani Bazell for up till about 5:45, and then we'll hear from David Eisenman on the financial issue.
All right. And Don is great. Needed to say that as well. Yes, Don is great.
So, Imani, what about these 2 issues?
Yeah.
Which do you want to talk about, white racism or Sarah Palin? Or
Well, you know what?
She's awfully white, isn't she?
She's so white. Bless her heart. But you know what? That does a disservice to white people, so I probably shouldn't say that. She is not the best of what the white community has to offer. So, but it's up to the white community to challenge other white people. Mm-hmm. It just as it's, I am responsible as an African American for challenging other African Americans when they behave in stupid ways, when they say stupid things, when they claim to be representing the voice and the interests of black people, and I don't believe they are. I am uniquely responsible for challenging that as an insider. And as such, I think other white Americans are responsible for challenging white Americans around their racism, around their confused thinking, around their biases. And it's not fair to continue to put that burden on people of color. And there are many, many white people of conscience who've done a fantastic job with that, Steve. And I think we'll continue to, and we're really seeing that. And so I say, Sarah Palin, she's a pawn. Let me just say that amongst the people who I talk to, who I get 100 emails a day from and calls from, and as I move through this community and through the nation and my networks, mostly people understand her to be a pawn. And so on some level, I feel sorry for her that the leadership of the GOP is using her and causing her public humiliation. And maybe her ego is too big or she's too confused to recognize herself to be the pawn that she is. So that's a particular opinion that I'm representing. And that's really all I want to say about her is that I resent her being used as a pawn. And I resent the implication that other white people are so out of touch with their own self-interest that they would fall for her nonsense and for McCain's nonsense. And I resent that they sell women so short to think that just because she has the same plumbing as us, that somehow she represents us, which she does not. That's why race isn't the only determining factor, and neither is gender. It's what you stand for that's ultimately most important. So we try to teach the electorate to be issue-oriented, to vote on the issues.
And how do you analyze what might happen to white voters when they actually get in the election?
Yeah. There's a name for that, Steve. It's called the Bradley effect. Yeah. You've heard that term before. And where that term came from was when Tom Bradley was running out in California. And the polls said, you know, he would win. And then there was this big shock when he didn't win because so many white voters said, yes, of course, I can, you know, of course, I'm not afraid to vote for a black candidate. But then when they get in the booth, it's scary and they vote another way. And so that's why it's called the Bradley effect. And so what the pollsters are saying, people who are in the know about this question, they're saying maybe it's a... The last number I heard was maybe 6 to 7%. When we look at what the polls are saying, we might want to subtract as much as 6 or 7% from the. That's a lot from the numbers. But I said a little earlier, Steve, this whole movement around voter suppression. One of the things that we see is that the Republican machine nationally, I can't speak about it locally, but nationally has always been associated in the modern era with efforts towards voter suppression. Black voter suppression, urban voter suppression, that kind
college
of thing.
Student voter suppression.
College student voter suppression, because what they know is that demographically speaking, these would be the people who are most likely to vote Democratic. So if you can, anytime you have low voter turnout, you see Republican wins. The higher the Democratic turnout, I'm sorry, the higher the voter turnout, the more likely you're going to have Democratic wins. And so it's not just who's running. It's just a question of continuing to control the power structure. If you can suppress the black vote, you can stay in power. So around the question of white fear and white racism or whatever, it's fear-based. I think on some level, people know that there's been so much injustice in this country, and I think they're afraid, they're somehow afraid of some kind of retribution or something. But if they would just listen to what Obama is saying, if they would listen to what their own white brethren and sistren are saying, who are overwhelmingly in support of this candidacy, they can rest assured. One of the things that's so interesting, Steve, is you have now many, you mentioned labor, the labor movement, which we know is controlled by whites and white males in particular. They're speaking up, Steve, and they're understanding that a big part of their job in this campaign cycle is to go to their membership, to go to their base and say and call it what it is. And so for the first time, I'm seeing people who have often tried to diminish race. The thing that's different this time, and to get back to the woman who called, who was saying, what did I think about race relations? I think the thing we might be seeing this time, Steve, is not this thing about, you know, they keep talking about being a post-racial society or Obama's a post-racial candidate. That's not this colorblind thing that people often get stuck in. Oh, I don't see color. There's, you know, there's no racism anymore. I think what we're seeing now is more maturity, where people are willing to acknowledge that race is an issue and willing to struggle with that and struggle through that to get to the other side, as opposed to trying to skirt it and deny it. And so that is a new level of maturity in the public discussion and debate around race and racism that I think can move us all to a higher level. And again, I can't emphasize enough, I believe, breathe new life into making real the promise of participatory democracy for all of us. Because, Steve, we don't have the luxury. We don't have the luxury to leave people out. We're in trouble. We need everyone's best thinking. We need everyone's heart and soul and intellect engaged in this project of reshaping America and helping right the world. And so we don't want to leave anyone out, because when we do, we leave out vital voices and vital perspectives and creativity that we can't afford to leave in the dust, if I'm making any sense.
Absolutely. We have just a couple more minutes for you, Imani, and I know you had some local events you wanted to mention.
Well, yes. Speaking of the African-American electorate and voter participation, a veteran of the civil rights and voting rights movement, Mr. Charlie Cobb Jr., is here in town. He will be speaking in a number of venues on tomorrow, October 6th, and then Tuesday the 7th. He was involved. He was a field secretary for SNCC. That's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 60s. He helped develop the whole idea and proposal for Freedom Schools and Mississippi Freedom Summer. He also, some people on campus may actually know of his work with Bob Moses. They wrote a number of years ago a book called Radical Equations, which is about the Algebra Project, which was this idea of taking lessons from the civil rights movement and developing leadership amongst Black youth through understanding math and algebra, which is really exciting. So he's going to be here. And, Steve, we have a number. You have it in front of you.
It's 333-7781. That's within the 217 area code for information about when and exactly when and where Charlie Cobb Jr. is speaking here at the University of Illinois the next 2 days.
He's going to be talking about, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's 217-333-7781.
He's going to be talking about his recent book, which has sort of taken people through the journey, through a journey of the civil rights movement and different people and benchmarks, hallmarks of the movement. So that's what he's going to be talking about. And I also wanted to point out he is a journalist, and he's actually a founding member of the National Association of Black Journalists.
Our guest for this portion of Keeping the Faith this afternoon has been Imani Bazell, for 5 years director of the Center for Civic Engagement and Social Justice for the Urban League in Champaign County. We're going to move now. This is a little bit unusual for Keeping the Faith. Usually we can center on one guest for a whole hour, which is a real luxury.
Steve, but if I can refer people to a couple of things before get off of this topic. Really quick, if you want to get more information and perspective about the particular POV I've been sharing today,
yes,
I would refer people to, you know, there have been so many wonderful videos and things that have come out in this cycle. People know about the Yes We Can video and different things. Recently, I saw one by Sarah Silverman. You can just Google these things, where she's talking about the white Jewish vote in Florida and all. It's really funny, but she's actually really, really serious. So I'd Google Sarah Silverman. I saw a very profound couple-minute video. I believe it was called Israelis for Obama, and it's set in Israel, and people in Israel talking about the importance globally for this. There's a wonderful piece called The Great Black Vote. So I would ask people to get online and look around. I would also invite people to go to The Black Commentator, which is an online journal, Black Agenda Reports, TheRoot.com, and look up progressivesforobama.blogspot.com. If you identify as a progressive and you want to know more about how progressive people are thinking about this as a social movement well beyond the campaign, I invite you to get online and learn more about it. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much for being our guest. And let's move to David Eisman. David, you've been following this financial crisis of the last week or two and have some interesting thoughts about it.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, this emergency appearance on your program, I suppose, reflects all of the emergency in the voices of Charlie Rose's guests the last week. Are we really in a crisis that requires Congress to do something on a moment's notice of the size of several thousand dollars for every man, woman, and child in the United States? And let us say that we are persuaded that that is the case. I've been asking myself to approach this the way a physicist would, to do a thought experiment.
Which is your academic training.
Well, my training is as a physicist. Right. I mean, physicists would not, at this point, not claim me, but never mind. Training of your youth sometimes come through. So I have performed a thought experiment, and I want people to take it in the way physicists do, which is sometimes you think an outlandish experiment, one that you couldn't actually perform. And you know what? Some of these thought experiments actually get performed because they lead you to an interesting place. So here was my line of thought. What do nations do if you have a real crisis? Well, you round up the people you need. Imani was just saying that we need everybody sooner or later. And, you know, the French needed the taxi drivers at the beginning of World War I because they didn't have transportation to get troops to the front. So they rounded up the taxi drivers. And what did we do? As World War II opened up, we discovered that Hitler and that German scientists had found a way to split the atom, and Hitler might be working on an atom bomb. So we rounded up physicists and chemists and engineers and machinists and ordinary folk, and we sent them out to the desert in New Mexico, and we put them in a locked community. They could only talk to each other, because that way they could really get the problem solved. It was technically complex, and the usual compartmentalization that the Army wants wouldn't have worked. Robert Oppenheimer suggested a different approach. I'm wondering if something similar wouldn't work right now. Remember when we were told after the attack on the World Trade Center and with all that steaming rubble in the middle of New York City at thousands of degrees of heat, even after weeks after the attack, we were told that it would take years to clean that up. Notice that American ingenuity, our blue-collar workers and the engineers went in and did it. Well, I think, folks, it's time to call for volunteers. And if we don't get enough, it's time to do what we do in times of national crisis, and that's draft people to work on this economic problem. We're being told that the derivatives, the financial derivatives based on these securitized mortgage packages, are so complex that they will take years to unwind, and that the deleveraging of all the outrageous leveraging that took place in the last 4 years after the SEC removed restrictions on investment bankers, that too will be so complex it will take a long time to do it. Well, I don't think so. I think we call for volunteers. And let's round up all of the financial geniuses and computer assistants and financial advisors and bond lawyers. And I think they should go to southern Idaho. And we should have a new little camp, rather like Alamogordo, like Oppenheimer put together. I think if these bright people are put together in one place and they are inducted into the Army and get Army wages and live in barracks and get sea rations and have a real sense of national emergency, in the first place, we'll have volunteers. I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, all those people got laid off from Bear Stearns.
Sure.
So, and they have the right
minimum
skills.
Minimum wage is better than nothing.
But I really want to point out, if the country, what would we have said if the great George Catlett Marshall had announced in 1943 that after all, he was 68 years old and he had a family, he'd been in long public service, and it was time for him to. Paulson, who has just asked for $700 billion and no questions asked,
Secretary of the Treasury,
has announced that he's leaving in January. Do you leave in the middle of a crisis that could put us into a 10-year depression? I don't think so. I think that we need, well, in the first place, we should have some volunteers. I think that there's no question that Mr. Greenspan should be a general in this project. President Clinton has much to answer for. Lots of things happened on his watch, and some of his secretaries are available. I think they can go. Karl Rove could do the coffee and keep everybody focused and motivated. And after all, President Bush will be available come January. So I think we need a draft, folks. I did my best on Friday, but Congress passed this bailout thing. Of course, there will be a conference committee between the House and the Senate. During this, we need an amendment in which Paulson is absolutely required to stay on for as long as the next president wants him. These men should not just leave. So that's my proposal, folks. That was my thought experiment. If this really is a national crisis, if we can draft young people, if we can raise armies of young people to fight our shooting wars, let's raise an army of financial geniuses and support staff to unwind the damage done by the financial geniuses and their support staff, including their deregulation friends in the Republican Party. Keep them in uniform. Keep them there for the duration, as we said in World War I. So that's my modest proposal. I'd love it if people would comment.
We do have almost 5 minutes for callers. It's 333-9455 here at WILL. If you're a local caller, long distance, 1-800-222-9455. Some of you heard the announcement that on This American Life that immediately follows Keeping the Faith here locally, there'll be a whole hour looking at the causes and what might happen with the financial crisis. But if we thought this would be a good warm-up for that, and I see we have a caller on line number 4. Let's see if we can get to that caller. I'm not sure if that's quite ready yet. Okay. We may be having a technical issue. Let's go to line number 1. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. I think I'd prefer to fire Secretary Paulson tomorrow than keep him on for the duration.
Oh, no, he could make the coffee. I didn't say that he necessarily would. I just don't think he goes home. Don't you understand? I mean, that's the point.
Home.
Yeah, it doesn't get to go home.
Yes, now I understand. Yeah, or perhaps we could find a little room for him somewhere. I've got the point now. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. And line number 4, our toll-free line. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with David Eisenman.
Hi. I just would like to say I think it's brilliant. Finally, common sense and logic. You should run for public office. I would love to see these yahoos get, put somewhere in uniform for the duration. My son-in-law has served 2 tours of Iraq, a tour of Afghanistan, and Bosnia. It's time we get a diplomat and somebody with some sense in office. And I think parking a bunch of folks away and making them solve the problem would be excellent.
Well, start a movement. Tell all your friends. I think if we the title of this one is Draft the Financiers, Put Them in Southern Idaho for the Duration.
I love it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. David, for people who'd like to see your whole argument in print, do you have a website or an email address where people could
Unfortunately, not yet, but it's been submitted here and there. I think it may even appear in a local paper soon.
All right. So people
just
could
keep your eye
it,
open.
All right. Very good. Imani, do you have a reaction to David's modest proposal?
Of course, I love it. I love the idea of drafting them.
Yeah, you're
I'm good.
You're
okay. On. Yes. I love the idea of drafting them. But one of the things I want to add to this is when we think about, because you said there'd be volunteers. And what the volunteers I'm looking for are people who have been left out of the discussion, because there are many brilliant minds who understand economics very well, who can be found left of center of the political spectrum. And if we can, like I said, get everyone's best thinking in the room, And here's our chance. Yeah. Here's our chance because we finally are able to prove, sorry it's so painful, that supply-side economics has not served our interest, that trickle, that mink coats really don't trickle down. And so I think that there's an opening, there's a small opening of opportunity to get a broader range of political economic perspectives at the table to say, okay, we put up with it, we let you try it your way, now you've got to open this door a little wider and let some more people in to give our best thinking about what our economic social order should look like.
Well, that's the bigger political picture, of course, but we have a technical crisis on our hands here, not all that different from cleaning up the destruction of 100-story towers. I am not prepared to say that every financial derivative is a bad idea. Actually, some very clever ideas have been thrown around in recent years. Our difficulty is we don't have what the Republicans think we have, which is true capitalism with lots of competition. Look at the we're down to what? We're down to two big investment houses. We only had six when this crisis began. The difficulty here is that things are too big to fail. The difficulty, for example, in the deregulation of electric power, which was a brilliant idea, was that we ended up with two companies owning all of the power plants. If, in fact, deregulation had been in a truly competitive market, it might have worked differently. This is a technical task, just as wars are technical. And we were so successful in the Second World War because people of all sorts came forward and brought their backgrounds. We do need financial advisors from Champaign to be sent to South Dakota. They've been selling securities here. They can go to South Dakota and sort it out. Did I say South Dakota? Southern Idaho. Very sorry.
And do you have a particular reason for picking that
location? I've been
buying
land in Southern Idaho. I don't think that Citibank should get all the pickings in this crisis. And you heard me say that.
We've been enjoying our two guests today on Keeping the Faith. David Eisenman is the voice you heard most recently talking about the financial crisis and his modest proposal. Imani Buzzell was our main scheduled guest talking about African-American electoral issues, and we thank them both for being on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host, and next week I'm privileged to be talking with Reverend John Sutherland, a Lutheran pastor, after his 2 years as a Lutheran pastor in Palestine on the West Bank, and we'll be talking about some of his reactions to those 2 years. And then our guest who just slipped in for a little bit today, David Eisenman, will be talking about ethical issues about drugs on October 19th here on Keeping the Faith. October 26th, Sister Agnes Cunningham, Catholic theologian, will be talking about her very distinguished life as a theologian in the Catholic Church. James Wellman, the author of Evangelical versus Liberal, will be our guest on the Sunday right before Election Day here, November 2nd. And Daniel McCollum, former mayor of Champaign, will be our guest November 9, talking about church-state separation based on his new book. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.